Well, good morning. I feel right at home. I'm from San Diego, and this weather feels just like San Diego. So, I mean, this is wonderful. This must be like this all year round. Is that right? Yeah. Yeah, come back in January. Yeah, I might just try that. Yeah, we'll see. Yeah, and it's good to be back again in Petoskey, not just because it's a beautiful town. I was excited that Pastor Michael was willing to have me come back. And not that I was concerned I wasn't going to be invited back because of something I said perhaps last year, but more because I'd flooded Susan's apartment in the basement. So I was a little concerned that might be an issue this time, but I was glad to see that not only did she have me back, but she invited me back in a sense. So that was encouraging. Well, good. Does everyone have notes? Anybody not have notes? How about that? All right. We'll follow along pretty closely to the outline, so I encourage you, if you'd like to follow along with notes, to use them. We're going to be talking this morning initially about the art of conversational persuasion, which is really about how do you convince people of ideas? How do you use natural forms of communication in order to communicate either the gospel or respond specifically to challenges against your view? And I remember many years ago, I was working as a physical therapist. This is before I was in this line of work. I was working in East LA at a hospital called LA County USC Medical Center. And Los Angeles is a pretty ethnically diverse city. And so one of my friends was a Hindu, and he asked me out to lunch. So we went out to lunch, and I was happy to do that. And we were sitting across from one another eating some fish tacos there in downtown Los Angeles. And he proceeded to tell me that he's going to be getting married. And I was like, oh, Raj, I'm so excited. Congratulations. And I went ahead and decided to ask him a question. I said, Raj, are you going to have a Hindu wedding or are you going to have like an American wedding? You know, I was wondering to what degree is he carrying over his Hindu culture into his wedding. And he said, oh, I'm going to have a Hindu wedding. And I said, oh, that's great. And so I asked him another question. I said, Raj, is Hinduism something that's important to you? Or is it just sort of the cultural aspects that you like to follow? Or do you believe in the religious aspects as well? He thought about it for a moment. He goes, no, it's important to me, very important to me. I said, oh, that's great. I said, Raj, so I asked him another question. Is Hinduism something that you think is true? He thought about it a little bit longer. He's like, yeah, I think Hinduism is true. So, okay, great. So I asked him another question. I said, Raj, do you think all religions are true? Like, do you think not just Hinduism is true, but also Islam and Christianity and Judaism and Buddhism? I mean, do you think all religions are true? And he thought about it for a little bit longer, and after a pause, he said, yeah, I pretty much think they're all much the same. Now, at this point of the conversation, I came to realize that my friend Raj is what's known as a religious pluralist. And this is simply the idea that all religions are true. You can't say that any one particular religion is more true, whereas others are false. You certainly couldn't say any religions are wrong or mistaken. And as a follower of Jesus Christ, this was not my conviction, nor is it today. And so I wanted to talk my friend Raj out of continuing to believe this view of religious pluralism. And so I asked him one final question. I said, Raj, let me ask you. I said, what would you think about a religion that taught that its deity was a physical god that was the size of a football field, that hovered on the far side of the moon, and was responsible for controlling the weather patterns on our planet? I said, what would you think about a religion that taught that? Would you also think that that religion is true? He thought about it for a moment, and then he started to smile, and he goes, well, yeah, I guess I wouldn't think that that religion is true. And then he said, I guess I don't think that all religions are true. I take that back. Maybe just the ones that sort of make sense. And so he sort of backed away from this religious pluralist idea. Now, notice what I didn't do in that conversation. I never said to him, Raj, you're wrong. I didn't say, Raj, you believe in religious pluralism. Let me tell you why that's mistaken. I didn't defend any Christian conviction. I didn't even tell him that I was a Christian at that point. Yet I was still able to communicate the idea that religious pluralism is something that perhaps he should abandon. And what was the only thing that I did in that entire conversation? Ask questions, that's right. I asked not just any question, but a specific set of questions that led him down a certain line of thinking. And in fact, as he answered these questions, it was almost as if the ideas that he was believing were his own thoughts. partly because he was answering these questions in his own mind. In fact, had I said to him, Raj, oh, you believe in religious pluralism, let me tell you why that's mistaken, it's far more likely that his defenses would have gone up. If I'd said, you're wrong, and let me tell you why. But instead, I used questions to gently guide him down a certain line of thinking such that he came to this final realization of what idea I wanted to communicate. And this is the habit that I want you to get into, is using questions in conversation a lot more than you perhaps previously have in order to advance a conversation or to make your point or to respond to objections. Now, I want to first give you some context as to where this kind of idea or where even this teaching is relevant for us as believers and followers of Jesus Christ. And particularly, the Apostle Paul tells us in 2 Corinthians 5:20 that you are ambassadors for Jesus Christ, as though God were making his appeal through you. And so we learn from this, and this is really our theme verse at Stand to Reason. And we say, well, man, if we're an ambassador, what does that look like? What does that mean for us as believers? And perhaps you could probably think of a political ambassador. So just imagine for a moment, if you were an ambassador to, say, the country Iran, what skill set would you need to be an effective ambassador? What are some skills that you would need to be effective if you're being an ambassador to Iran? You tell me. Was that language? So you need to know what language. So you need to know Farsi. Right. If you want to be able to be an ambassador, you've got to at least speak the language or understand it to a certain degree. If not, you'd have to have a translator, which isn't as ideal, but certainly that's one thing. Absolutely. What else would you have to have? What's that? Okay, understand their culture. That's right. And how it's different from the culture that you come from. And perhaps you might use that information about their culture in order to draw upon that knowledge to make your case more persuasively, perhaps. Good. What else? What other skill set would you need to have? What other qualities or characteristics as a person? Oh, okay, yeah, genuinely interested in them. That's right. When they're speaking, you don't want to just be kind of like dozing off and thinking about lunch. You want to be actively interested in what they're saying. That's right, or the next question. You know, it's like, okay, as soon as they're done, as soon as their lips start flapping, I'm going to jump in there with my, you know, my comment. Absolutely. What else? Yes, Kim. Yeah, that's right, patience. Yeah, especially with some countries. But yeah, absolutely, you want to be patient because obviously it's going to take a little bit of extra time in order to communicate ideas. Good. What else? All right, you have to care about them. Yeah, you have to generally be concerned about perhaps their welfare or your relationship with them. Absolutely. Good. What else? Yes? Okay, not judgmental in their answers. So what does that look like? What do you mean by that? Okay, yeah, so you have to expect that being a different country, they're going to say things that are radically different than what you're used to hearing or what you believe. So you want to perhaps maybe reserve judgment initially or perhaps, depending on what they're saying, be kind of back off a little bit because, again, you're speaking to a different country. Good. Yes, Carolyn. A purpose. And where would you get your purpose from? Okay, and so if you're an ambassador for, say, the United States, where does your purpose and belief system come from? So in other words, if you're an ambassador for the United States to Iran, who are you representing? The United States, right. So in this case, you would be the country that you represent is really what your purpose is going to be about, right? Obviously, if you're from Brazil, you know, to Iran, then of course you're presenting Brazil's foreign interests, and that will be your purpose. So depending on what or who you represent will determine what your purpose will be. Absolutely. Good. Anything else that comes to mind? As any kind of qualities or characteristics? Okay, yeah. You want to have, you want to be diplomatic. You know, you want your skills in communication to be clear and effective. Absolutely. Yeah, good. Anything else that comes to mind? Being an ambassador for a country. These are all right on the money. In fact, you could probably take all of these characteristics and qualities, and indeed many more, and lump them into three broad categories. And I think they're listed there on your notes, but they're also here. Knowledge, wisdom, and character. Probably all three, all of the characteristics and qualities that we've mentioned could be put into these three categories. And I would say that as an ambassador for Jesus Christ, we function in a very similar way to an ambassador from a foreign country, or from your country to another foreign country. In that, we also, as ambassadors, have to have knowledge, wisdom, and character. So knowledge is simply an accurately informed mind. And this kind of goes to what Carolyn was saying. You have to know something about your purpose. And since we are ambassadors for Jesus Christ, we need to have knowledge of his message, the message of the gospel. We have to know something about what we're communicating to the rest of the world. But as also you've kind of alluded to, knowledge would not only entail knowledge of what you're going to communicate, but you want to have knowledge of their culture as well. You want to have knowledge of their foreign policy interests. And so as an ambassador for Jesus Christ, we only not want to know something about the Bible and God's message and his plan. We want to know something about our culture that we're trying to speak to, the American culture, if we're living in the United States. What are the philosophies of American culture that are driving people's thoughts? We want to know something about that so that we can draw upon that knowledge when we communicate the gospel. But you realize, though, that having simply knowledge of the truth and or of the error would not be enough to be effective, right? You have to be able to take that information and communicate it in a way that is persuasive and clear. And that's where wisdom comes in, an artful method. It's the diplomacy. It's the how do you communicate well, you know? And because you can't just take information and dump it on people. That would be overwhelming for a lot. And so that's where wisdom comes in. How do you take the knowledge and channel it in a way that is clear and effective, using language that makes sense to people? And so perhaps that would be, in our case, avoiding a lot of common Christian lingo that we often use. You know, we might say, Jesus Christ died for your sins. And that might roll off our tongue quite easily, and we think that makes perfect sense to us. But for people who are unchurched, that's just gobbledygook. They might understand who Jesus is, but why does someone have to die for a sin? What is a sin, for that matter? You know, this whole idea of atonement might make perfect sense to us because we kind of perhaps grew up in the church or even listening to Pastor Mike's messages for so long that our theology is like, you know, through the roof. But the reality is, people who don't understand this, it doesn't make sense to them. And we are seeing more and more of our culture be less and less familiar with Christian theology. So you have to have knowledge. You also have to have wisdom. But you realize probably that even if you had a ton of knowledge and tremendous skill in communication, if you were a jerk when you spoke to people, if you were condescending, if you made people feel foolish or stupid, then your poor character would undermine your message and bring shame to the person you represent, namely Jesus Christ. And that's why character is a third key component to being an effective ambassador. We want to have knowledge, absolutely. We want to be able to communicate that knowledge effectively and persuasively, but we also want to have a winsome, gracious, kind, and inviting character, such that our character commends our message. And keep in mind here, when I say character, I'm not saying we should be honest or we should be people of our word, which of course we should be. But by character, I mean conversational character, meaning the manner in which we're communicating should be warm and friendly and inviting. And that's what I'm talking about in terms of character, an attractive manner. So these three are essential components of being an effective ambassador. And as we talk about tactics, what we're really talking about is the wisdom portion of this. So in this first section before lunch, we'll be looking specifically at how do you communicate in a diplomatic, artful method. Okay, we're not looking so much at knowledge. We're not going to be looking at, like, what are some good arguments against atheism or against evolution or against abortion or homosexuality or anything like that. We're looking more about how you can use the art of conversational persuasion in communicating any idea or being able to respond to critiques to your faith from other people. That's specifically what we're looking at here. Now, keep in mind here that there's a ton of benefits to these tactics, and we'll learn probably about four or so depending on how much time we have. But these tactics help us to do a lot of things. First of all, it'll help us to present the truth, I believe, in a very clever and artful way. But probably more importantly than that is that it'll allow us to choreograph our interactions. What does a choreographer do? Does anybody know what the function of a choreographer is? Plan the steps? Yeah, that's right. Were you a dancer before? Or? No? Okay, yeah. A choreographer takes the number of people who are involved and coordinates their movements, exactly. My wife used to do ballet for many years before she was in physical therapy like me, and now she's a full-time mom. But and so she would often have a choreographer who would say something to her in terms of what she'd want her to do on the stage. So a choreographer would say, okay, I want you to start right here on this end of the stage. And the choreographer has in their mind how this is all going to play out, what moves the dancer will do. So perhaps the choreographer will say, okay, I want you to start off by running really fast and maybe doing a jump and doing a twirl and then ending up over here on this part of the stage. And the choreographer has all that kind of planned out in their mind where they want the dancer to go and where they want the dancer to end up. And in the same way, this is what tactics will allow you to do with conversations, and that is choreograph your conversation. So you remember my story I talked about with my friend Raj. As soon as I discovered he was a Hindu, I immediately knew where I wanted to go in a conversation with him, and that was over there. And so what did I do? I used questions to guide the conversation over here, to over here, to over here, to over here, such that at the end of the conversation, we ended up right here with him faced with this question. You think religious pluralism is true? Well, then what are you going to do? I didn't say that word, of course, but what would you do in a situation where you have a religion that believes this ridiculous thing? And I wanted him to be faced with that question because I realized that when faced with that question, there's only really one answer. And so I used questions to guide the conversation such that we ended up over here. And that's what I mean. It allows you to choreograph your interactions with people. That's how powerful these things are. Of course, it also allows you to stop people who are challenging you. Sometimes people are very aggressive when they're criticizing your faith, and this will help you to deal with that. But ultimately, tactics will help you to recognize someone's bad thinking for the purpose of guiding them to the truth, and here's the key point, while remaining gracious and charitable. Okay? Remember, we're ambassadors for Christ. However we come across to other people will be a reflection of the person we represent, Jesus. And so that's the ultimate goal of tactics. Now, you might be thinking, man, Alan, that sounds kind of manipulative what you're talking about. Choreographing your interactions? What, are you trying to twist people into a pretzel here? You know, you treating them like puppets? No, not at all. But I realize that the way this comes across makes it sound like, man, tactics can be abused quite easily. And that is absolutely true. If you have the wrong motive and intention, you can certainly abuse tactics and make people feel foolish, make people feel stupid, corner them, and that's not the purpose of tactics. Okay? If you're using these skills to belittle people or humiliate them, well, then you're being a bad ambassador for Jesus Christ. Okay, that's not the purpose of this. The purpose is to guide people to the truth. So just be aware of that, that as we go through these things, man, they are powerful, but we should use them for the purpose of guiding people to the truth, as we'd want to with anybody when we're trying to share the gospel. So keep that in mind. Now, when you think about sharing your faith or talking to a person, let's just say, for example, an atheist, hypothetically, what comes to mind when you think about talking to another person who doesn't share your convictions? Would you say you're number one? Would you be like, yeah, I relish the encounter. Bring him on. I can't wait to talk to this non-believer. Or would you say you're number two? You're like, well, you know, I'm willing to have a conversation with someone who doesn't share my faith, but you know what? Frankly, I'm a little bit nervous sometimes, or I could be uncertain about what I'm going to say, or scared, you know? Or would you say you're a three? You're like, I'm going to run the other way, okay? So just out of curiosity, raise your hand if you would say you're number one. You relish the encounter. Okay, we've got a couple, all right? What about number two? Raise your hand if you're number two. You're willing, but all right, seems like the majority of you. Anyone here number three? That's fine. Don't be embarrassed. How many won't raise their hand no matter what I ask them? Okay, just a few, yes. Of course, this wise Alex there. Yeah, so I'm curious, just for, okay, so those of you who raise your hand for number one, you can just kind of take a nap for 5 minutes here, but for those of you who are a two or a three, tell me, what are you nervous, uncertain, or scared about, or what causes you to perhaps run the other way? What are you, what's the concern for those of you who are a two or a three? Rejection. Okay, you might say something and you might be completely rejected. Perhaps your idea is rejected, perhaps you're rejected, you know? Absolutely. What else might be a concern? Yeah, Kim? I know what you mean. Like they're able to make their point as opposed to you making your point. That's right. Yeah, you're thinking like, oh man, here's an opportunity for me to share the gospel or share a moral truth or something. You start the conversation and they end up succeeding in making their point rather than you. Overpowering. Okay, good. Yeah, what else? Yes. I know what you mean. Yeah, your dialogue with them. Yeah. So you're concerned, man, I might not have enough knowledge to speak on whatever topic we're addressing. Good. Yeah, Wally. Okay. Yeah, right. Okay, so two things there. One is, how do you even get started in the conversation? How do you enter into a conversation about religion or ethics or something? But then once you're in there, it's so easy for that conversation to get sidetracked. And kind of knowing how do you get things back on track rather than kind of following a rabbit trail is sometimes a difficult thing. And that's a concern for me as well. So, yeah, two things. Yeah, good. What else? Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, you have an opportunity and you end up really blowing it, and actually it makes things worse perhaps for the. Yeah, that's a real concern. Good. What else? What else? Yes, Susan. That's right. Yeah, at most places at work, you're not supposed to talk about two things, right? What are they? Religion and politics, right. And unfortunately, this kind of falls under the religion heading. So, yeah, there might be policies. Even when I was a physical therapist, you know, I worked in a hospital setting. And so many times I'd be working with people who were, I was always working with hospitalized people, people who were admitted to the hospital, which usually means something serious was going on. In many cases, they were at the lowest point in their life in terms of physical ability. And so it was natural for conversations about the meaning of life, and whether, you know, there's purpose to what's going on, and is this trial something that's, is there meaning to that? I mean, that's like a natural conversation that would oftentimes come up. And so, yeah, I felt also I had to be very careful about what I said because there were certain policies that prevented me from saying certain things. That's right. What else? What are the concerns about there? Yeah. Time? That's right. Sure. Right. It might be you're going, you know, checking out the grocery store, and you got, you know, maybe 30 seconds. It could be a server at a restaurant, and you only have a few minutes here and there, perhaps because they're busy. You may, you know, maybe something. You see an opportunity that the door is open to say something, but you don't have a ton of time. You know, how do you address the gospel? You know, and you know. 30 seconds or so. Yeah, it could be tough. Good. Yeah, Mike.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Good. Very good. Anything else that comes to mind? Now, I'll tell you that when I do this little kind of quiz, if you will, or kind of evaluation, I actually put myself as the number two. Now, keep in mind, I get paid to go to secular universities and stand up on a stage presenting in front of a university audience that wants to tear my head off and say something about homosexuality or Islam or abortion, and then be willing to take people who want to debate me on the spot, with microphones. So you might think, well, gee, Alan, you must have no problem. This must be something that you're not afraid of. You should relish the encounter. The truth is I don't. I get nervous, I'm uncertain, and I'm scared a lot almost every time I've ever done it. So it can't be that simply our fear of these things is a problem because, there's still a reason why I'm doing it. I believe that despite the fact that there are these real concerns that we might have, fear is not the problem. It's only when that fear paralyzes us from ever taking the initiative to step out into a conversation with somebody. And I believe if you have good tactics, or you know good tactics, this will help you, despite your fear, to actually move forward and engage people in conversation. Because good tactics can help you, even if you don't have a ton of knowledge on the issue, even if you're unprepared, even if you have perhaps like policies that prevent you from saying things really explicitly about the gospel. I believe these tactics can help with perhaps actually all the concerns that you have raised. Because I have the same concerns that you've all mentioned, fear of rejection, all these things. But yet, I still think that now with tactics, I'm able to do them far more with far more confidence. So that's what I want to do is say, look, I think actually just in the next, say, 30 minutes, the two initial tactics I'll teach you alone will help you tremendously with moving forward in the conversation, even if you have a bunch of these fears. So let's take a look at a good tactic here. But before we do, I want to show you an example of a bad tactic. And how many of you, I'm curious here, how many of you have ever seen the movie Nacho Libre? Raise your hand. Nacho Libre. No? Have you seen it? No? Okay, so, yeah, it's okay. I wouldn't expect you to. But this is it's kind of an older movie. It's a comedy. It's about these two Mexican wrestlers. And one of them, portrayed by the actor Jack Black, is a Catholic. So he's a Catholic Mexican wrestler. And this is his partner. And his partner here is not a religious person. He's kind of an agnostic. Okay. And so Nacho Libre, who's currently off screen, you'll see him in just a moment because I'll show you this clip. He's concerned because they're about to wrestle these two guys named Satan's Cavemen. And so Nacho Libre is concerned because they're going to wrestle these guys that are kind of demonic, you know. And his friend is not a Catholic. He's not a religious person. And so he wants him to get baptized. So I want to show you what tactic Nacho Libre uses to convince his buddy that he should get baptized. Okay, now keep in mind, it's a comedy, so you don't take anything here too seriously. All right, so let's take a look at how Nacho tries to convince his friend to get baptized. So, what do you think? Was that an effective tactic? Tim's like, yeah, it sure was. Do you think his friend is now more convinced that he should get baptized? Because there's probably a good theological question of whether he was actually baptized or not. But is his friend more likely to want to be baptized now? Why not? It was kind of aggressive. Okay. No preparation, all right. No choice. Okay. Yeah, Kim. All right. No explanation. Sure. Yeah, it's just like... No, it was definitely not a winsome and gracious, inviting manner, was it? No, that's right. I mean, it's because he forced them to do it, you know? And when you're forced to do something, you almost put up a natural resistance to that very thing. But see, this is often how we come across as believers when we're trying to talk to people about our faith. We're telling them statement after statement after statement. It's almost as if we're dunking people's heads in the water. Hey, you've got to believe in Jesus. He died for your sins. There is a God. He's for real. The Bible's the word of God. You got to, you know, it's like, oh man, people are like, oh, okay, ease up there, buddy, you know. And this is kind of the picture that I see that comes across to others when we're so forceful in trying to tell people what to believe. And again, I'm not saying we shouldn't be forceful and incisive and whatever, but I believe that if we modify our approach, and instead of just simply making statements, we use a more tactical approach, I believe it'll be far better. And this first tactic I want to teach you is called the Columbo tactic. And how many of you have ever seen the TV show Columbo with Peter Falk from many years ago? Yeah. I used to watch this all the time. And you know, this guy was a master at figuring out who the criminal was in every TV show, right? You'd see the beginning, you'd see the crime play out. And then Peter Falk would come on the scene, Lieutenant Columbo. And, you know, he came across as sort of this bumbling, you know, foolish detective, right? He'd walk in, he's wearing a trench coat, it looks like he slept in it, you know, it's all wrinkled up. He's got, you know, bedhead. You know, he pulls out a piece of paper and he wants to take notes of the crime scene. He doesn't even have a pencil. He's like, hey, anybody got a pencil on your bar? And the criminal who's standing there is thinking to himself, well, I'm never going to get caught. This guy's a fool, you know? And so the key to his success was that he came across as very disarming, very as approachable, innocent, nothing to be concerned about. Yet he did something consistently throughout every episode that eventually helped him to figure it out. And you know what it was? He asked questions, lots of questions, you know? And these questions were so kind of like obvious, like, hey, you know, where were you yesterday during when this person was killed or whatever, and they'd be like, oh, well, I was with my son playing basketball. Oh, of course, yeah, yeah. Well, so silly of me, you know. Hey, he just come across as very innocent and disarming. And that was the key. And that's really the key to the Columbo tactic, is to use questions instead of statements to be able to make your point or move forward or advance yourself in a conversation about religion or morality or whatever you're talking about. That's really the heart of this tactic. Using questions instead of statements, okay? And this is really the queen mother of all the tactics, because it can be combined with other tactics. As we look at some of the other tactics in a few minutes here, we'll be adding on to this approach. So we'll use questions as the foundation for how we build all our other tactics, because questions is really the key to helping you with this. And by the way, these tactics can be used not just with non-believers, but really with anybody. You can use them with your spouse, your kids, your parents, your friends, because they're simply the basic rules of logic. They're basic principles of everyday conversation. They can be used on any topic, with anyone. So you can use them with any person or with any topic, whether you're talking about the gospel or the Bible or the resurrection or Islam or homosexuality or whatever it might be. And that's the beauty of them. Now, what's the benefit? What are some of the benefits of asking questions? When you're in a conversation with someone, what benefits are brought to the table when you're using questions instead of statements? Yeah, Ron? Okay, yeah, it keeps the conversation going. It's so much easier for a conversation to die out if you're just simply you talking, you know? Yes? It's a way, did you say guard? Oh, garner, yeah. Oh, get information, yes. So it tells you information about what they believe, you know. By asking questions, they're going to answer statements, and they're going to tell you information about themselves. Absolutely, that's huge. What else? Yes? That's right. That's right, yeah. If you're asking questions, it actually looks like, and hopefully you actually do, care about them and are interested in what they have to say. Absolutely, and that's huge. It makes people feel dignified and worthy to be able to be involved in that conversation. Good, what else? What are the benefits of questions? Okay, yeah, it keeps the burden off you. Obviously, if you're asking a question, well then, it's almost like, instead of you're the one who has to be kind of in the hot seat, the one saying all the things that have to be true and accurate and precise, well, when you ask a question, they're now the ones who are sort of in the hot seat, if you will, who has to answer questions or, and be kind of on stage, if you will. You want to say something else, Ron? Okay, tell me, what do you mean by that? Okay. Okay. All right. Yeah, so... Oh, I'm sorry, go ahead. Yeah, so when you ask them a question and they kind of tell you about their views, you know where you can start that conversation. It'll give you an idea of where they're at, so you know where you can begin. I mean, if they come across and they have a basic understanding, perhaps, of theology, you may be able to start further down the line than if they're completely unchurched. I'm not trying to put words in your mouth. Is that what you meant? Okay. Yeah, good. Anything else that comes to mind? Yeah, so these are all true. The only thing that I'll add to that is that they allow you oftentimes to make your point without ever stating your case. Just like I did with my friend Raj. I was still able to make the point that religious pluralism isn't a great idea without ever saying religious pluralism is false. You know, I never said that. Yet I was still able to communicate that idea. And that's one of the hugely powerful things. Francis Schaeffer, who's arguably he's like the C.S. Lewis of the 20th century in terms of philosophy. So C.S. Lewis was more perhaps a popular speaker who was hugely, hugely influential, obviously. Francis Schaeffer was a philosopher, and I'd argue in his role as a philosopher, as a person who was experienced in apologetics, was as influential in his field. And so he's certainly one of the most awesome philosophers of the 20th century. Listen to what he said about the power of questions. He said, "If I have only an hour with someone, I'll spend the first 55 minutes asking questions and finding out what is troubling their heart and mind. And then, the last 5 minutes, I will share something of the truth." Wow, that's huge. 55 minutes of an hour just listening to somebody else talk about their atheistic views and non-Christian views, but that seems like to give them the upper hand. And yet he's saying, no, that's what I do. I ask them questions to find out about where they're at. Almost like you're saying, Ron, find out even where to begin with the person. Find out what is troubling their heart and their mind. And then I know precisely where to come in at, you know, and address this issue because now I have a better understanding of their view. So again, I hope you could see the importance of asking questions and how powerful this is. So here's the first question. There's different ways to ask questions. I want to talk about two in particular. And the first one, the first kind of question, first kind of Columbo question, tells you what a person thinks. It gives you the content of their ideas or of their belief. All right? And here's the key question. What do you mean by that? Now notice, anyone here can say that, right? Well, what do you mean by that? In fact, I asked Ron, what did you mean by that? I think somebody else said something. I said, what did you mean by that? Right? All you're asking is for clarification of their view. Okay? Very, very simple and straightforward question. Now, you don't have to memorize what do you mean by that. Really, any question that asks for more information about a person's view will work. Okay? Tell me more about that. Explain to me. Define for me this. Can you say something more about what you meant when you said X or Y, whatever? So again, it's just simply getting more information about their view. Now take a look at a couple of examples here of situations where I've been on a college campus or talking to non-religious people, and they've said these kinds of things. Okay, all religions are basically the same. All right, it's kind of like what my friend Raj said. Now, I know that all religions are not the same. I've studied different religions, not thoroughly, but I know well enough that this is completely false. But yet when somebody says this to me, I don't respond with, well, they're certainly not the same. Let me tell you why. Islam teaches this. And I don't go into that conversation. Instead, I simply ask, well, what do you mean by that? A Columbo question. What do you mean by the same? What do you mean by all religions are the same? Now think about it for a moment. We don't know what they mean by that, do we? Because when they say all religions are the same, they could mean all religions lead to the same God or worship the same God. Or maybe they mean that all religions have the same moral requirements. Or maybe they mean something else. We don't know. And so by asking, well, what do you mean by the same? They are now going to tell you what they mean by that so you can accurately know how to respond and not respond to something that they're not saying. Okay? They might say something like, well, the Bible isn't reliable. You know, I don't know about this whole Christianity. It just doesn't seem like the Bible's reliable. And you might say, well, Alan, I mean, you must certainly know why the Bible is reliable. And I do, and I could give an hour lecture on that, but I don't. When someone says this to me, my first response to them is, well, what do you mean by reliable? What do you mean the Bible isn't reliable? Tell me more about that. Because in reality, I don't know what they mean. Perhaps they mean the Bible isn't a reliable source of history. Or maybe they mean the Bible isn't scientifically accurate. Or maybe they mean the Bible hasn't been reliably transmitted for thousands of years, such that what the Apostle Paul wrote 2,000 years ago is what we're reading today in our scriptures. Maybe that's what they mean. I don't know what they mean. And that's why when I ask them, well, what do you mean by that? Well, then they'll tell me. And notice also, sometimes we're confronted with a statement like this, and initially we're kind of like, oh, we're paralyzed. What do we say? The Bible's reliable. I don't even know where to begin. Okay, and then we say, well, what do you mean by that? And they start saying, well, it hasn't been transmitted reliably. And we're like thinking, oh, well, wait a minute. I know something about that. I heard something about the Dead Sea Scrolls, and maybe I remember that the Dead Sea Scrolls prove that the manuscripts that show how the Bible's been copied for thousands of years are extremely accurate. And so initially, when they said the Bible isn't reliable, you kind of didn't know what to say. Then you ask them, well, what do you mean by that? They start giving you more information, and that triggers something in your memory, and you know now what to say. Okay? So it can help you because it gives you more information to work with. Sometimes these simple statements or objections like this, they might be overwhelming or they might freak us out or paralyze us. But we ask a clarifying question, and then now they'll give us something more that makes us say, oh, okay, well, I can deal with that. You know, I'm pro-choice. You know, a lot of people might say this, and they might actually be against most forms of abortion. You know, you say, well, what do you mean by pro-choice? They might say, well, I just think that, you know, I'm against most all forms of abortion, but not abortion in the case of birth control, for a form of birth control. Well, that sounds a lot more pro-life than pro-choice in reality. And so that's why even when somebody says pro-life or pro-choice, you may not know what they mean. And so by asking, well, what do you mean by that? Once they clarify it, it'll help you to figure that out. Evolution's a well-proven fact. How many different definitions of evolution are there? Does anybody know? Yeah, at least two, micro and macro. And in fact, I'd argue there's a couple more. But yeah, just let's take these two definitions. I know a lot about evolution because I've studied it. I teach on it. But when somebody tells me that they believe in evolution, my response is not to give a 30-minute lecture to them or even a 5-minute response. I simply say, well, what do you mean by evolution? Now, evolution, as Wally was mentioning, could mean microevolution, which are simply small changes that take place amongst a species. So, for example, Adam and Eve had a certain hair color, certain height, certain, you know, build, certain skin color, you know. But now we look around the earth and we see people of all different skin complexions, different hair color, different heights, different, you know, bone structures. There's been a tremendous amount of variation. Well, these are just micro or small changes within a species. We're all still humans. But obviously, we've adapted to different environments based on climates and stuff. This is no big deal. We all acknowledge that that kind of limited change can occur. No big deal. Your doctor will tell you if they give you antibiotics, what do they tell you to do with that pill, with that bottle of antibiotics when you get sick? Take them all. And why do they tell you that? That's right, to prevent resistance. If you start taking your antibiotics and you start to feel fine, you're like, well, I don't need to finish this off. I feel fine. The reality is that some of the bacteria in your body are still alive, but just not enough to make you sick. So what happens? Well, they develop a resistance to that treatment that you've been taking, the antibiotics. Then they grow back, and then you get sick again, and then the antibiotics that you were taking will no longer work. Well, that ability of bacteria to adapt to an antibiotic is known as an evolutionary change, but as a microevolutionary change. It's microevolution. Now, do we all believe that that happens? Well, of course we do. That's no big deal. That's not controversial. And so if that's all they mean by evolution is a well-proven fact, you could say, yeah, I totally agree with you. Now, if what they mean by evolution is macroevolution, and that is the story that there was once a single-celled life form that came about by chance from non-life, from dirt and water and chemicals, and that single-celled animal, maybe like a bacteria, eventually evolved to multicellular bacteria, into larger organisms, into eventually alligators and humans and giraffes and Venus flytraps, you know. Well, that's a whole different story about evolution, and that's macroevolution. And if that's what they mean, well, then that's a different conversation. But notice the Columbo question, well, what do you mean by evolution, is key. Because if all they're saying is that bacteria can adapt to antibiotics, okay, yeah, I believe that too. Well, that certain species have limited amounts of change, yeah, I believe that too. You know, humans look different. Yeah, so what? So this is, you see how it's important to understand exactly what they're talking about, and that's why this question, what do you mean by that, will help you with this. Notice also, I think it was you, Scott, who mentioned, this question also takes the pressure off of you, right? You're in a conversation, and they say, well, I can't believe in Christianity because I believe in evolution. And you're like, uh-oh, now it's all on you. What are you going to say? You know, spotlights come on, everyone's staring at you, you know. You say, well, what do you mean by evolution? And now, all of a sudden, the spotlights, they turn back on the other person. And now, you take a deep breath. You have a few minutes to kind of collect your thoughts. And as they're answering the question, you have some chance to kind of like, oh, I have a chance to kind of take a deep breath and think about my thoughts and hear what they're saying. And maybe they'll give me something else I can work with. So it takes the pressure off of you. It takes you out of the hot seat. Puts them on the hot seat. Not in an inappropriate way. In a legitimate way. You know, you just want to know about their views. It also, by the way, and I think perhaps Ron, I forgot, or Wally had mentioned this, it helps keep the conversation going. Was it you, Ron, who was saying this? You know, a lot of times these statements are said to end the conversation because people feel uncomfortable. Maybe you're at work and they say, well, you know, I'm not comfortable talking about, you know, religion. And, you know, I all religions are basically the same. In other words, just be quiet. Stop talking to me about this Jesus thing. And when you say, well, what do you mean by the same? You know, that now breathes new life into the conversation. Because instead of the conversation ending, they have to explain what they mean by the same. So again, all these different benefits. Ultimately, though, what do you mean by that? This first Columbo question tells you what they believe so that you don't misunderstand them and also so that you don't misrepresent them. Because certainly you don't want to answer or respond to something that they didn't say. But worse, you definitely don't want to take their view, and maybe you didn't understand it, so what you do is this. You misrepresent their view, and then you respond or critique a view they do not hold. Does anybody know what this is called, by the way, if you were to do this in a formal, like a debate? If two people are debating, and somebody takes this other person's view, and they misrepresent it so that it looks foolish and stupid, and then you attack that other view rather than the view they actually hold, there's actually a term in logic that's refers to this. Does anybody know what it's called? Not ad hominem. We're actually going to look at that in a few minutes. What's that? Yes, straw man. So it's called a straw man fallacy. Straw man fallacy. And this is actually embarrassing. So it's embarrassing in a formal debate, but you don't want to do it even in conversation. You don't want to misrepresent a person's view in a way that makes them look foolish and then attack that view. And by the way, the reason it gets its name straw man is because it's a lot easier to knock down a man made up of straw than it is to knock down a real man, like our former governor in California, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger, right? Right, because if you had to, like, punch one of these people out, it's going to be a lot harder to knock this guy down. Of course, he's a lot older and isn't as ripped anymore, but, you know, it's going to be a lot harder to knock down a real man than it is to knock down a straw man. But that's what a straw man is. It's a weaker version of the real thing. And that's what sometimes, if we don't understand a person's view, we do. We say, oh, you believe in evolution? You believe we all evolved from apes? Oh, that's really funny. Yeah, how come there's a bunch of apes around if we evolved from them? Now, this is a straw man. The reason is because evolution does not teach that we evolved from apes. Okay? What evolution teaches is that apes and humans share a common ancestor, that there was some animal that evolved into apes and another line evolved into humans. Now, that might seem like a small, minor point of definition, but in reality, when we say things like, well, no, humans evolved from apes like this, it makes us look foolish. It shows that we don't understand their view, which makes us look foolish, and then we're also misrepresenting their view in a way that's a lot easier to criticize, and that's committing a straw man. And that's why asking, well, what do you mean by that, will help you to avoid such a mistake. Somebody I remember was also asking me one time, they said, well, hey, Alan, I have a friend who is a Mormon, you know, and I'm not Mormon, of course, I'm a Christian, and, you know, I want to know, what book should I get so I can study it and then respond to my Mormon friend? And I said, you know what, don't get a book. Here's what you do. Call them up, or the next time you see them, say, hey, let's meet at Starbucks and chat. And sit down with them and just Columbo them to death. Find out about their views. Ask them, hey, tell me about Mormonism. What do you guys believe, you know? Tell me about, you know, Father God and Mother God and how, you know, they're creating souls on the planet Earth and how, you know, me and Jesus and Lucifer are all spirit brothers. And tell, you know, whatever it is their view is. I mean, that is their view, but I'm kind of giving away some of their views. But the bottom line is sit down with them and just ask them, hey, tell me about your beliefs. What do you believe about the afterlife? How do you believe you go to heaven? You know, what is heaven like? Instead of getting a book which might teach you about proper theology of Mormonism, but they might not even actually hold that view. Instead, the Columbo tactic is more engaging. It tells you specifically about their views rather than about what Orthodox Mormonism believes. And it also it tells you specifically about their unique beliefs so that you can respond to them rather than something that they don't hold. So again, the Columbo tactic is far more powerful than just simply reading a book, I would say, in some cases. Now, am I saying don't study formal theology? No, of course not. But if you want to know about someone's views, just meet with them. You'll build your relationship with them, and you'll find out about their unique views. So, any questions here about this first Columbo application before we move on to the second application? The first Columbo tactic tells you what? What does it tell you? This first application. What's that? What a person thinks, right? And what's the key question to ask? What do you mean by that? That's right. What do you mean by that? Or tell me more about your view, and I'll tell you what they think. Good. Any questions or concerns about this first application? Yeah, Ron? So if you've asked them, what do you mean by that? They explain it. Okay, so... right, so in other words, if you ask them, well, what do you mean by that? They answer it about evolution. Let's just say they believe in microevolution. And then you think, well, then where do we go from there? Okay. Well, if you just re-clarified their view, you haven't challenged them. If you've just said, so you're telling me what you believe in is, you know, that species can change within a limited amount. And they say, yeah, that's exactly what I'm saying. If that's all they've said, you've just clarified their view. Most likely, if they initially said, well, evolution is what I believe, then they perhaps have reasons for that as well, which the next question will help you figure out what it is. So let's do this next part, and then let me see if that perhaps addresses where you can go next. Because this next question will tell you not just what they think, but why they think it. And this will help to advance the conversation still some more. Any other questions, though, before we move on? Comments or okay. So that's a perfect segue, Ron. So this first Columbo question, or the first application of it, tells you what they think. The second Columbo question will tell you why they think. And the purpose of the second application is to reverse the burden of proof. Now, before we look at burden of proof, we have to first understand a key component here, and that is what an argument is. And this will be fundamental for the rest of the morning, so make sure you get this. And if you don't, be sure to ask me a question about it. But can anyone give me a general definition for an argument? There's two components to this definition that I want to get at. And just a hint, it's not bickering or yelling or fighting, okay? What is kind of the yeah, go ahead. Okay, so you said two people having different points of view about a similar subject. So one part of the definition is that you have to have a point of view, but in actuality, you don't even have to have two people to make an argument. So you got half it right, and that is you have to have a point of view, but just having your own point of view or your belief or your opinion is not enough to make that an argument. Something else is needed to make this point of view into an argument. And what is that other thing? What's that? You don't need an opposing view to make it into an argument. You need something else. So if I was to say, well, my point of view is that God exists. Well, that's just an opinion, or that's just a claim. There's something else I need to add to that in order to make it an actual argument. Yes? Okay, what do you mean by knowledge? What do you mean by that? See? You hear me say that a lot. Yeah. Yeah. What was that? Oh, okay. Is that what it is? Okay, so it's on the outline. All right. Yeah, that's right. So yes, what you need in order to make that claim into an argument is proof or knowledge of why that's true. You have to have reasons for your claim. So all an argument is your opinion or your belief or your view with reasons to back it up. In other words, some people liken an argument to a house. Okay, a house has roof, and it has walls that support the roof. The roof is like the claim, or your opinion, or your belief. But notice, if you just had a roof sitting on the ground, that wouldn't be a house. You have to have walls to support it, and hopefully not a lot of water at the bottom that is eroding the walls. So, in the same way, in order for you to have a bona fide argument, you can't just have an opinion. You have to have reasons to back it up. Okay, that's what makes it into a bona fide argument. So, for example, when my wife says to me on a Tuesday, she might say, well, Alan, hey, what should we do for dinner tonight? And I say, well, let's go to Taco Bell. Now, I've just given her my opinion or my claim. Let's go to Taco Bell. But then she says, because she's kind of a health nut, she's like, well, why should we go to Taco Bell? Now, what she's asking me for is reasons. And so I say, well, because on Tuesday it's, you know, two tacos for a dollar or whatever, some deal. So now I've given her reasons why we should go to Taco Bell. I've just offered her an argument. Notice that's all an argument is. It's my view, we should go to Taco Bell, and the reasons to back it up, because we'll get a discount. That's all an argument is. In reality, we make arguments or offer arguments all day long. Hey, you know, after church, let's go to the side door saloon, you know. Hey, you know, let's go golfing tomorrow. Why? Because, you know, it's a beautiful day, you know. That's an argument. Notice it's not mean. It's not aggressive. It's just, hey, here's my view, and here's why I think we should do it or believe it. Okay? So, with that understanding of an argument, what is the burden of proof? What is the burden of proof? Does anybody have a definition for this? Obviously, it's a term used in legal circles quite often. Okay, the facts that back up the position. So yeah, that would be the reasons why your view is true. But burden of proof is a reference to the responsibility somebody has to do something. And what is it? It's related to what you just said. That's right. So the burden of proof is the responsibility that someone has to back up their claims or to give evidence or reasons for their view. Now, if I was to accuse Ron of stealing my car, and Ron said, I didn't steal your car. You don't even have a car here. You have a rental car, in fact. So why would I steal your car? I said, no, Ron, you stole my car. And we have an argument, and we can't resolve it, and we go to court. There's a trial. Now, if we get to trial, and I say, Ron has stolen my car, and they say, well, what are your reasons? Well, I don't have any reasons. I'm just saying that he stole my car. Who's going to win the trial? He is. What do I have to provide in order for him to be perhaps accused or found guilty? That's right, evidence. And but doesn't he have to? I mean, what if I said nothing and he offers no defense for his view? Who gets off free? He does. Right, because the burden of proof is on who? Me. It's my burden to provide evidence or reason that he stole my car because I'm the one making the accusation. I'm the one making the claim that he stole my car. And in the same way with arguments, the person who's made the claim is the one who bears the burden of proof. That's the way this rule works. Whoever makes the claim bears the responsibility to give evidence or reasons for their view. Whoever offers a roof is responsible for providing the walls to support that roof. Okay? Now, having said that, I want to claim, and this is a thing in your notes, it says no more free rides. We as Christians need to stop giving people free rides. And here's what I mean by a free ride. And this is perhaps the biggest mistake I see that makes evangelism harder than it needs to be. We're in a conversation. So we see there's a Christian talking to a non-Christian. And they're having a conversation about religion. And the non-Christian says, all religions are basically the same. Okay. They've made a claim, right? Here's what the Christian says in response to that. Oh, no, they're not. All religions are not the same. Islam teaches that Jesus is just a prophet. Judaism doesn't even acknowledge that Jesus was a prophet. And in Christianity, they believe that Jesus is the Son of God. See, they all different. They all contradict one another. So how could they all be? And they speak for about 5 or 10 minutes defending against a person's opinion. Not against their argument, against an opinion. What that is a free ride. The Christian is going to extra lengths to respond to an opinion which they don't have to. Remember, the burden of proof rule is whoever makes the claim bears the burden of proof. So if a non-Christian says to you, all religions are the same, who's made the claim? The non-Christian. So who bears the burden of proof? They do. Now, if you make the claim, well, I think God exists, or I believe that Jesus rose from the dead. Now who's made the claim? The Christian or the non-Christian? The Christian. So who bears the burden of proof? The Christian does. Okay? And so notice, this is why I'm telling you, you are not responsible for shouldering the burden of proof when someone else makes a claim. And this is perhaps the biggest mistake I see. Christians are notoriously bad at this rule because they hear someone make a claim, all religions are basically the same, and instead of letting them shoulder the burden of proof, they take the burden of proof upon themselves, which makes the task 10 times harder than it needs to be. It's not your job to respond to other people's opinions. It's your job to make them shoulder the burden of proof if they've made the claim. But if you walk around life thinking that it's your job to respond to every wild and wacky story that anybody can spin, then of course you'll feel hesitant to want to share your faith. Because if they say something like, well, Jesus traveled to India, and that's where he learned about reincarnation, you're like, well, how do I respond to that? You don't have to. They've made this crazy, wacky claim. By the way, people do say this. They're the ones who made the claim. Let them give evidence or reasons for that wacky view. It's not your job to respond against it. But that's how Christians have somehow ended up finding themselves in. Anything that anybody spins up, we're like, oh, I got to respond to that. No, you don't. I remember one time I was talking about God, and I was like, well, they're like, well, you can't have evidence or reasons for God's existence. I said, well, no, I think you can. And so I offered a quick argument from science and philosophy that I think was showing that there's reasons why we should think God exists. I gave reasons for it from science and philosophy. And here's how they responded. No, I don't think that's the case, because the universe doesn't need a cause like God. It could have just came into existence by itself. There could have just been a bunch of mathematical points, numbers swirling about in the universe of nothingness, and they swirled about and started to come closer together. And as they approached one another, they formed a singularity, and bang, the whole universe popped into existence. And I said to them, why would you think that that's true? I mean, I didn't feel like I had to respond to this mathematical swirling point argument because it wasn't an argument. It was an opinion that they just made up. I don't have any obligation to give a response to that. That is merely their view, not an argument. So don't feel compelled to respond to non-arguments. Instead, make them shoulder the burden of proof. And the way you do it is with Columbo. And this, before we get to that, I want you to, have you been given, there's a little interactive there, a little conversation. Before we look at the kind of the solution to this, I want you to see if you understand this burden of proof rule. So I want you to get into pairs, and if you don't, if there isn't two people or there's an odd number, you can do threes. But you'll notice there's a conversation between John and Chris. And John is sort of this, like, perhaps a non-believer. Chris is sort of representative of the Christian. And they're having a conversation about stem cell research. It doesn't matter what that's about, per se. You don't have to know. But just read through it with your partner, and then I want you to figure out who is the person that has the burden of proof in this conversation. So don't say it out loud. Just whisper it to your partner here, and then we'll go from there. So I think there's a... if there's three here, there's a person here behind you who doesn't have a... Oh, okay. So just go through it. We'll just take a minute, read through it, and then figure out who shoulders the burden of proof in this conversation. Okay, so let's come back here and try to figure this out. So in this conversation, I'm talking about stem cell research. Again, Chris, sort of like the person who's identified here like a Christian, and John, sort of the non-believer, if you will. Doesn't really matter, but who would you say bears the burden of proof? How many think John bears the burden of proof? Okay, how many think Chris bears the burden of proof? Okay, how many think they're right? Yeah. That's right. Yeah, that's the correct answer. Actually, it turns out both of them bear the burden of proof because both of them are simply making statements, neither one of which is offering any reasons for their view, right? I mean, it does start off okay. You know, John says he can't believe anyone would believe against stem cell research. Chris is like, well, isn't stem cell research immoral? Which is a good question to ask, you know. John, you know, yeah, you know, what do you mean by that? You know, Chris is like, well, what's extreme about saying stem cell research is wrong? And so it starts off okay. But then at the end, the conversation starts to degenerate. Chris is like, sure, they're human beings. John, no, they're not. Chris, yes, they are. No, they're not. Yes, they are. You're a jerk. No, you're a jerk. You know, it's like, it just like gets worse as the conversation goes. But neither one of them is offering reasons for their view. No one's offering walls for their roof. They're just offering roof after roof after roof, statement after statement after statement. You know, they're just dunking, you know, each other's heads in the water, if you will. And so, yeah, in reality, in this case, both of them shoulder the burden of proof because both are making claims, neither one of which is offering evidence or reasons for their view. And so what you want to do then is to use the Columbo tactic to make a person shoulder the burden of proof, to enforce that rule. And the key question to ask is, how did you come to that conclusion? Pretty easy question to ask, right? If someone makes a statement, like all religions are the same or something like that, don't feel compelled to respond to an opinion. Instead, just ask them, how did you come to that conclusion? It doesn't have to be those exact words. You can say, well, why do you believe that? Or why should I believe that? What reasons do you have for thinking that what you said is true? You know, it's not a big deal. It's not a trick. That's a reasonable question to ask. I tell you, if you said to them, Jesus died for your sins and I know he exists because he was around in Judea, they're going to say to you, well, why should I believe that? So they would naturally ask you this question. So what's the big deal without asking them the same question? How did you come to that conclusion? You know, people say to me, well, the Bible's been translated and retranslated so many times that you can't possibly know that what the Apostle Paul wrote 2,000 years ago is what you have today. Now, I've studied textual criticism. I know about the reliability of the Bible. I know a lot about this. I could spend an hour or two talking to a person about why that statement is false. But I don't. I make my job much easier by simply asking, well, how did you come to that conclusion? I mean, what's easier to say? 20 minutes of trying to dig up a whole bunch of stuff on manuscript evidence and reliability, or how did you come to that conclusion? What's easier to say? Obviously, the latter. And that's not a trick. It's not avoiding anything. It's the proper question to ask. Tell me, why do you believe that? So you know how to respond appropriately. Jesus taught reincarnation after traveling to India. Really? Well, what reason do you have for thinking that's true? The universe came into existence by itself. Do you have any evidence to back that up? Stephen Hawking, the most allegedly brilliant man in the universe? Richard Dawkins, the most famous? You made this statement. Could you give me some evidence as to why that's true? All religions are basically the same. Really, why would anybody think that? Have you ever studied religions? The Bible is full of fables and myths. Can you prove to me how you know that that's true? Every living thing came from a single-celled life form. What reasons do you have for thinking that's true, or believing that? Science has proven the Bible wrong. How did you come to that conclusion? Notice all of those statements, although they appear to be challenges to your view, they are not. They are merely roofs sitting on the ground. They are not bona fide houses. They are not legitimate arguments. And don't treat them as such. Instead, just ask them how they know that that's the case. It's so much easier. It's the appropriate thing to do. And again, this question, how did you come to that conclusion, has also the same benefits as the previous question. What do you mean by that? Right? It engages them in their view. It shows that you care about what they think about. It reverses the burden of proof. It buys you valuable time. It takes you out of the hot seat. It puts them in the hot seat. Right? When they say, well, evolution is the way we all came about, you're like, yo, what am I going to say? What am I going to say? Well, tell me, how did you come to that conclusion? It takes the pressure off of you. Spotlight's on them. They're in the hot seat. Right? And that's where the pressure belongs. That's where the burden belongs, is upon them, because they've made the claim. Now, turn back to that little interactive, and I want you to figure out what's one question either John or Chris could ask that would make the other person shoulder the burden of proof. So pick one of the people, either John or Chris, and try to figure out with your partner what's a question that John or Chris could ask of the other person that would help them shoulder the burden of proof. Take just a minute to figure this out. Okay, so does anybody have a question that one of the people could ask of the other person? Yeah? Okay, so Who's asking that? Is Chris asking John that? Okay. So yeah, what is the definition of human? So that would be, that's more of the first Columba question. Like, what do you mean by that? Right? Because you're asking them, well, what do you mean by human being? You keep saying they're not human, but what's your definition? So that would be finding out what they believe. Okay. But we want to try to figure out how to reverse the burden of proof. So we're trying to figure out, how could you make them shoulder the burden of proof, the other person? Because Chris is saying that these stem cells are human beings. John is saying they're not. So they're both making claims. What question could be asked of either one to ask the other for reasons for that view? Yeah, Wally? Sure. Yeah. Yeah. Why would you think that? Why would you think that nobody could be against that? So that would be everything. Yeah, Michael.
Mm-hmm.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. So, all right. So the first question would be the Columba, the first application, which is finding out what they believe, you know, and clarifying, well, stem cell research, well, what do you mean by that? Because there is embryonic stem cell research and adult stem cell research. And I believe embryonic, personally, is immoral and adult is perfectly moral. So that would be a key question. What do you mean by that? But then assuming that that's discovered, and the assumption here is that they're talking about embryonic stem cell research. But yeah. Where was the question? There it is. Yes, I'm sorry. Yeah, what reasons do you have for thinking that stem cell research would help a lot of people? So yeah, that would be a perfect question that reverses the burden of proof. Good. Any other possible questions? Yeah, any question that the other asks of the other person that basically is why? Why? Why should I believe what you just said? That would do. Yeah, Scott?
Why does it matter where you came from? Third statement about the religious people. Yeah, they may hold that view, but
oh, okay.
Why would that be a benefit?
Yeah. That's right. Why does it matter that a religious person holds this view? Right. Do we automatically disqualify religious views? Yeah, so that's a good question. Yeah, so all these questions would again, enforce this burden of proof, in a burden of proof rule. here are a bunch of statements that I hear when I'm talking to non-believers. And so, again, partner up and just pick maybe two of them, any two you want, and try to think of a Columba question that would reverse the burden of proof to any of those questions. Remember, reversing the burden of proof is taking someone's opinion and asking, why do you believe that? Okay? So again, getting your groups of two or three, pick two of these statements. You can pick more if you want, if you're super ambitious. And just try to think of one question that reverses the burden of proof, that asks, why should I believe what you believe? Okay? So take a couple minutes to do that, and then after this, we'll be taking a break shortly. So. Don't make this more complex than it has to be. Remember, reversing the burden of proof is merely asking, why should I believe that? What reasons do you have for thinking that's true? So just a hint as to how you would answer any of these. All right, so let's try a couple of these. So perhaps one of you can raise your hand and offer a Columbo question that reverses the burden of proof. And just tell us which statement you're referring to and how you'd reverse the burden of proof. So, who wants to be first? Who wants to be second? Okay. Okay. That's right. Perfect. Somebody says to you, all religions believe in the same God, you can ask, how did you come to that conclusion? That's the correct answer. Okay, let's try that again. Anybody else have another one they want to try? The Bible's been corrupted, okay. That's right. The Bible's been corrupted. How do you know that? Or how did you come to that conclusion? Ah, that's pretty easy, huh? Okay, next. Anyone have another one? Yeah, Kim? Okay, why do you think Joseph Smith was a prophet of God? Or how did you come to that conclusion? Okay, that's right. Do you see a pattern here? Let's try another one. Okay, yeah, homosexuality is the same as heterosexuality. Why do you say that? Or how did you come to that conclusion? Right, absolutely. Notice all of these are simply roofs without walls. They are statements, they are opinions, they are claims. None of them are offering any reasons. But notice that all these statements, when put in a conversation with a non-believer, if they were said to a Christian, would often either paralyze the Christian, freak them out, or make them be like, I don't know what to say, or I don't even know where to begin. Here's where you begin. Just ask them to give reasons for why they would believe any of these statements. So evolution is the way all life emerged? Here's what I would say. How did you come to that conclusion? God can't exist if evil and suffering can't exist? How did you come to that conclusion? Joseph Smith is a prophet of God? How did you come to that conclusion? Or Muhammad was a prophet of God? Whatever. The Bible's encrypted. Women will die in back alleys. Muslims and Christians worship the same God. All of these, I literally say to people, how did you come to that conclusion? Even though every one of these, I could give an hour lecture off the top of my head, just whenever I need to. But I don't. Because that makes it harder than it needs to be. If I felt pressured to have to dump out all that information, whether I had it or not, I'd feel less likely to want to talk to people because, man, at any moment they might say, homosexuality is the same as heterosexuality. And then how am I going to have to answer that? I got to explain that. I don't. Huh? How did you? Why would you think that? Yeah, Kim. Yes, it is challenging for me. Yes, I am. And that's the problem every Christian has, is that they're in the habit of hearing a statement like this, homosexuality is the same as heterosexuality. Oh, no, it's not. Romans 1 says that the wrath of God is being revealed upon these homosexuals. It's like, well, that went off really, really badly. Because what happens is we're so tempted to give this knee-jerk reaction by responding to an opinion. And you know what they say about opinions. Everyone has opinions, right? So we, even myself, I'm in the habit of responding. I hear an objection. I mean, this is my job, right? I hear an objection. I know the answer to it. And I got to bite my tongue, like you said, to get myself, stop, don't say anything. Make them shoulder the burden of proof. Otherwise, you're giving them a free ride. You're making their job so easy, and you're making your job much harder than it has to be. This is not a trick. It's not the wrong thing to do. It's the appropriate, logical, and even, I would say, dignified thing to do. Because you're assuming that they have reasons that led them to conclude that statement. And so you're asking them, what reasons do you have for thinking that? Now, be prepared to either have them give a blank stare, because they're not used to Christians saying, well, why do you believe that? They're used to Christians always shouldering the burden of proof, no matter who's making a claim. Or they might say, well, you know, the Bible's been translated so many times, and you can't know what it says. You know, I read that on the internet, you know, and people are talking about this on the internet all over the place. Then I'd be like, really? You believe everything you read on the internet? I mean, that can't be a reason. But most of these statements are simply urban legends that people have just been repeating over and over. They see it on the internet, on Facebook or whatever, and they're just repeating it. And they're so used to Christians responding with a defensive posture rather than challenging them with, how did you come to that conclusion? Believe me, most of my atheist friends now do not make these claims anymore unless they have reasons to back it up, because they know if they say to me, well, Alan, you know, Islam is, you know, such and such, or homosexuality is this, I'm going to say to them, how did you come to that conclusion? And they've realized they can't get away with saying these statements anymore unless they can first back them up, because I'm going to ask them that. And so it appropriately tempers them from making these wild claims, because they just think they could throw out anything. You know, hey, look, Jesus wants to, you know, come into your life and give you the power to overcome this addiction and allow you to have forgiveness. And they're like, are you kidding me? Jesus went to India and, you know, learned, taught reincarnation. That's just been taken out of the Bible. And they're like, oh man, how am I going to deal with that? You don't have to. Just by them saying that, they don't wave their wand and dismiss everything you said. You got to say, well, why would anybody believe he went to India? What? Where did you get that from? I mean, you don't want to sound like you think they're stupid, but I'm just saying that for effect to show you how ridiculous a statement like that is. Yet we dignify it with, well, I don't think so. I mean, I think scholars have shown that he didn't go to India, and I you know, it's like, why would you have to even say anything other than, why would anyone believe that? Yeah, Wally, were you going to say something? Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. Yeah. That's right. Yeah, yeah, of course. That's right. Right, the character part of knowledge, wisdom, character is where this comes into play. I'm simply saying, why would you... I'm doing that to exaggerate... for your purposes, but yeah, don't say it that way. Why would anyone believe such a... Police! I mean, no, you don't want to do that. Yeah. Yeah. It might be artful, it's just not strategic. You know? Yeah, like you said, you know, tell me, that's an interesting point. I've never heard this about India. Where did you hear about that? Tell me, how did you come to believe that? Well, you know, I thought I heard somebody say, oh, okay, well... So you don't have any reason then? Yeah, don't you want to say? Okay. Yeah, then you can say. Yeah, Susan? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's right. And in fact, many times, if you challenge them with, how did you come to that conclusion? And they either don't have an answer or admit that they don't have an answer... You know, you don't then go in for the kill. It's like, oh, once you taste blood, you're like, oh, okay, so you're an idiot. No, like you said, you want to give them a safe opportunity. Say, oh, okay. And you let that be a big step for them. Because for them to concede that they don't have reasons for that might be a huge deal. And so I don't then keep pushing and pushing. So basically, you don't have reasons for any of your beliefs. So basically, all your atheism is unfounded. So basically, it's like, you don't have to do that. If they concede a point like this, like, oh, yeah, I guess I don't have reasons for that, you know. Just let it be. Maybe change the subject. Maybe shift to something else. That's okay, you know. That's huge for them, and you don't want to just press them on it even harder just because you've, like, tasted blood and you're like, oh, I'm going to go after the jugular now. So you're absolutely right. That's when character is really huge. You want to have them feel comfortable being vulnerable with you so that later on in the future when you talk about more stuff, perhaps maybe things more relevant to the gospel, then that'll be a bigger deal. So let me just point out a concern here with reversing the burden of proof that sometimes might trip you up. It's called a professor's ploy. It often happens in a classroom situation, but it can also happen in just everyday conversation with a person, like you're just talking to it one-on-one. But I'll explain it the way it looks like in a classroom. Oftentimes there'll be a professor who's maybe an atheist. He's teaching a class on world history, for example, okay? Lecture hall, 100 students in the lecture hall. He's teaching about world history, and all of a sudden, he'll tangent and start criticizing the Bible. And this happened. It happened to me when I was at a university. And students are like, what's going on here? He's like going off on the Bible. So there might be a student who's a Christian who's like, I'm going to use my tactics. He raises his hand, or she raises his hand, and she says, Professor, you made the claim that the Bible is full of fables and myths. Could you give us reasons for why that's the case? So she's, you know, employing the reversing the burden of proof, Columbo tactic. So here's what the professor says. They say, well, look, I'm an open-minded person. I'm totally reasonable. I'm willing to consider other people's viewpoints. So maybe you could tell us, ma'am, why you think that the Bible is not full of fables and myths, why you think it's true and reliable. Now, what has the professor just done right there? That's right. She puts the burden of proof on him, where I would argue it belongs. He's like, he tricks and says, well, I'm willing to listen to your opinion. Tell us why you think it's true. And he puts the burden of proof back on her. And that's what often happens, because professors have been doing this for years, so they know exactly what a Christian student's going to say. And so, yeah, you can't take the bait in that situation. You can't be like, well, I don't know. What you want to say is simply, well, wait a minute, professor. I'm the student. You're the teacher. You're the one who's made the claim. You know, you tell us why we should believe what you just said is true. Or should we just take what you said on faith? No, you don't want to say that. But that's kind of what you want to say, right? Because it's almost like, well, they're like tricking you into this. And so, but this happens in everyday conversation too. You're talking. They make a claim. You say, well, how did you come to that conclusion? And they say, well, you tell me why you think you're right. Like, wait a minute. You're the one who made the claim, not me. You know? So just be aware of that. All right. Any questions, comments, concerns about this first Columbo, this first tactic, the Columbo tactic, either about what do you mean by that or how did you come to that conclusion? Take a little break here in a minute. Any concerns, things that came up? So the Columbo tactic is about using questions. The first question that tells you what a person believes, what's the key question? What do you mean by that? And if you want to find out why they believe something, what's the key question? That's right, how did you come to that conclusion, or why? Okay. And again, you could Columbo them to death for an hour or two. If you sat on the airplane and you turn to the person next to you because you're flying from here to San Diego to visit me, you're like, oh, four-hour flight, got a lot of time, got an open ear here to present the gospel to this person. And it turns out, as you take off and you started talking about the gospel, that they're Richard Dawkins, the most famous atheist in the world. You're like, oh, no, what am I going to do? No problem. You could Columbo him to death, you know? Hey, tell me about your beliefs. Why do you believe, you know? And if, let's just say Richard Dawkins does say, or the person you're talking to does say, well, I'll tell you why I believe in evolution. And all of a sudden they give you one, two, three reasons why they think their view is true. Well, then now what? You're like, how do you Columbo yourself out of that? Well, here's what you do. If they do give you reasons for their view, you can do one of two things. One is you can respond by saying, oh, okay, let me tell you why. Here's my response or my thoughts to that, if you know the answer or if you know how to respond. But guess what? If you don't know how to respond because you've never heard this argument or it's out of your league, do what I do. Here's what I say. Well, that's an interesting point. I've never heard that before. Man, you know, let me think about that. Can I get back to you maybe, you know, tomorrow when I see you at work or next week when I see you at, you know, whatever? And then you go home and you call your pastor, Michael, and you say, hey, guess what? I ran into this guy and this is what he said. Or you check our website, str.org, find the answer or whatever. Do your research. You come back to that person the next week and say, hey, I was thinking about what you said about evolution, and it occurred to me that, and then you can respond. I mean, that's literally what I do when I'm on a stage and I get a question that I've been, and I get a challenge that I've never heard of. I say, I don't know. I've never heard that before. Hey, let me get back to you. Is that okay? Let me think about that and get back to you. No big deal. You don't have to know everything. I don't know everything. So just say, hey, let me think about that. I'll get back to you. That's all I do. So, but in many cases, the Columbo tactic will allow you to just kind of keep moving forward in a conversation, get information about their view, figure out why they believe it, then you know how to respond directly, where to enter into the conversation, or you go back home, you do your research, and you come back next time and you say, hey, I was thinking about what you said, and it occurred to me that, and respond, okay? All right, let's take a break, and then we'll come back, and then we'll build upon the Columbo tactic. So